Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Laham Harkov, diplomatic correspondent, and I'm here, as always, with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. This week we have, I guess we could call it a Palestinian special. We're going to have Jerusalem Post Palestinian Affairs reporter Khaled Abu Tuameh on the show, as well as Khalid Shikaki, the premier, I would say foremost, holding in Palestinian society. We're going to talk a lot about the Palestinians, but I'm sure that people tuning in who are regular readers and followers of the Jerusalem Post are very curious to hear about the eventful weeks in the offices of the Jerusalem Post after we were hacked by Iran. So, Yaakov, you were the one who was up in the middle of the night dealing with crisis management. So tell us about that.
Well, it was interesting. That's a lot that I could say. I think so. Sunday night, I got a call at about 2 a.m. from Tamar Beiri, who is the managing editor of our website, who had yet to fall asleep that night. She was up working late and suddenly sees that the website crashes. What we then proceed to see and discover is that the whole homepage is covered now by an image of what looks like a missile falling on what looks like the Dimona reactor in Israel.
And there had been a similar image on some Iranian social media previously, right?
Right. And it came with wording in Hebrew as well as in English that said something like, we can do things that you can't even imagine, or we're close to where you think you do not think that we are. I don't know. It was bad English and it was bad Hebrew. But we couldn't get into the site, and the site was down, to their credit, to these hackers' credit. They were able to basically take over the Jerusalem Post website for about 3 hours until we were able to gain back control. It set us back a bit, but we had to think of what to do in the quick, I guess, response was what we tweeted out before. Then they tried to attack our Twitter account, and Twitter then froze our account there. Took us a bunch long time to get Twitter to reopen our reactivate our account so we could regain control of that. But thankfully, it was only frozen and they weren't able to get control. But they really tried to go all over the place. And what was interesting was definitely the timing. It was the 2-year anniversary to the targeted killing by then the Trump administration of Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force, the premier kind of elite Iranian, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps overseas operational force, which was led by Qasem Soleimani. He was killed in that airstrike in Baghdad airport back in January of 2020. And they did this on that same day. So it seems that, these were either Iranians, these were pro-Iranians. The fact that they're targeting the Jerusalem Post as their way to kind of commemorate the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, I think it's interesting. I think it definitely speaks to an extent, maybe we could pat ourselves on the back a little, Lahav, but I think that the Jerusalem Post is obviously an important Israeli and news publication, and is a publication that's read widely throughout the world, and they wanted to get a message across, and maybe they succeeded in that way.
Yeah, and I mean, individual Jerusalem Post reporters have been targeted. For years now, I've occasionally received sort of notifications from Google that some sort of state actor is trying to get into my email. But what was strange more recently is that I started getting emails from people being like, oh, I'd be happy to give you an interview. And I'd be like, who is this person? And it turned out somebody is impersonating me and asking all kinds of Israeli academics who write about Iran to give me interviews. So first of all, I'm going to say this for people's information. If anyone listening to this gets an email from lahavharkov@jpost.press, that's .press, not .com.
That's not you.
Not me. So don't answer.
And by the way, and add to that, Lahav is this website that someone founded in Gil Hoffman's name, our longtime political correspondent analyst.
Correct.
They founded some like blog looking website. I think it even has his photo, and it's gil/hoffman.com or something like that. And they made up a fictitious interview that he did with a former top Mossad guy, something about Azerbaijan and Armenia. Again, there's a lot of disinformation. I think these are, like you said, these are some state actors. Maybe some of them are not. But they have a very clear campaign, which is to spread fake news, spread misinformation, to use legitimate journalists like yourself, like Gil, to be able to spread that information to achieve their goals. And I think that this is part of, you know, Yonah Bob, our intelligence correspondent and legal affairs correspondent. So he interviewed a former cyber chief here in Israel who said that, look, this is part of an influence operation on behalf of the Iranians. And it was timed, as you know, because you've been writing so much about this, for the resumption of the talks on the nuclear deal in Vienna. So all of this is kind of coming, it's all part of the same kind of puzzle, I think, to an extent, right? And we're just a pawn in that game when they tried to hack us the other day.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, they're trying to intimidate Israelis. I mean, I hate to say it, but like, if they really want to intimidate Israelis, they should, or more Israelis, they should go for a Hebrew language website next time. Because most of our readers are not actually in Israel, even though we're based in Israel. But their goal is to intimidate Israelis. And so they're trying to find influential voices in Israel that they can sort of impersonate or take over. In addition to just their regular bots, I mean, for years and years, they've had all kinds of bots on social media. And we know over the years that Facebook and Twitter have taken down all kinds of Iranian accounts that were pretending to be Israelis.
Right.
And you can often tell because it's sort of pigged in is Hebrew. It's like really not clear Hebrew.
Yeah, I mean, but what they've also done, and I think that this hacking of our site shows, is it's also about intimidating Israelis, but it's also about being able to show that I'm successful and I can do something. We've been attacked over the years at the Jerusalem Post with what are known as DDoS attacks. Those are what are distributed denial of service. It's basically when, if I understand correctly, when you get sent tons and tons and tons of bots who, let's say, flood your server and try to enter your website at the same time, and then the server can't manage it, right? So like, imagine trying to go through a doorway which is only meant for one or two people to go through, but at the same time, 1,000 people try to go through the doorway, it won't work. And that's something that's happened to us before, and we're able to really push that away and prevent that from bringing down the site. This was a different scale. This was a different type of attack. And it shows A, a sophistication, but B, it also shows the investment that they're making in it, right? This was something a little different. And, you know, you mentioned the impersonations, right? They do these things to try to gain access. It's interesting. They're sophisticated. They're investing time, resources, money in all of this. And I think that they want to show the world that they have these capabilities. It's to intimidate Israelis, but it's also using an Israeli/international publication like ours, I think also is to make noise around the world and to show people what they can do. And they made some noise, right? And to that.
Yeah.
That, you know, maybe that helps them in some way. But how does it fit in your view, Lahav, to the Iran talks, which are still ongoing, right? You had a briefing with Yair Lapid the other day. He made some comments that were interesting that show Israel's still not happy, right?
Israel's not happy. I mean, and rightly so. It's not like anything is really going in Israel's way, but in terms of the talks, but Lapid thinks that there's going to be some kind of agreement because the Americans really want an agreement. And sort of the big difference between this government and the previous government, it's not that this government accepts or likes the JCPOA in any way. It's that Netanyahu thought that if Israel engages in any way with these talks to return to the JCPOA, it would be like giving a stamp of approval to the JCPOA in some way. Whereas this government thinks that, you know what, if it's going to happen, there's going to be an agreement, we should try to improve it as much as we can, even if it's just small improvements in the margins. And that was sort of what Lapid said, that there will be small achievements. There probably won't be a big achievement for Israel here. So, you know, and he set up this sort of like hierarchy where he said the best thing is a good deal. And if there's a good deal, Israel will support it. The second best thing is no deal with very, very strict sanctions, which is basically what Israel's been calling for now for months because they're negotiating some kind of deal. So, you know, Israel is trying to push that the sanctions should be as tight as possible, which, if the sanctions are as tight as possible, it'll be hard to get a deal, right? So,
right.
And then the worst thing for Israel is a bad deal, because a bad deal lifts the sanctions, gives Iran a lot of money, but also sort of gives them world approval for whatever they're doing, or at least they could feel like they have world approval, and it'll be much harder for the world to push back. So that's where things stand right now. You know, the talks continued this week. While we're recording this, there's no final deal, and I don't think that there's expected to be one now. People are talking about February.
So a bad deal for Israel means a deal that basically the Iranians get to continue doing what they want to do, and then Israel has to decide how it's going to act, right? And what we've seen until now, we've spoken about this in the past, is Israel is going to keep preparing its military, keep saying all options are on the table, but I think we've spoken about this. I think you do agree with me to an extent that once there's a deal, Israel's hands are going to be tied, right? And unlikely that Israel will be able to do something unless there's some blatant, really flagrant violation of whatever that deal might be.
Yeah. I mean, even though the politicians keep saying their hands won't be tied, I think Israel will have other ways of striking at Iran because Iran has so many proxies in the region, right? I mean, maybe we'll continue what we do in Syria.
Right.
But Iran directly, I think, will be made a lot harder if there's some kind of agreement.
Yeah.
If there's an interim agreement that's sort of supposed to, that they call it an interim agreement and it's supposed to continue negotiations at a later date, maybe Israel will feel a little freer. And that is a possibility.
Mm-hmm. The other big diplomatic news this week, Lahav, was the meeting in Rosh Ha'ayin, right? Late last week between Benny Gantz and Mahmoud Abbas, right? The Israel's defense minister hosted the Palestinian Authority president at his house in Rosh Ha'ayin, which is kind of like this sleepy suburb to the east of Tel Aviv. But it pretty much straddles the Green Line, if I'm not mistaken, right? It's just off a road, Highway 5. So just kind of before Ariel.
Right.
But anyhow, Mahmoud Abbas comes to meet with Gantz. And this is Gantz's second meeting with the Palestinian Authority president. They met a few months ago in Ramallah. In both cases, Prime Minister Bennett, who's known and has said publicly, right, that he will not meet with Mahmoud Abbas because of his support of the pay-to-slay system of paying the salaries to the families of terrorists and to the terrorists themselves and other reasons, said he knew about it beforehand. He was updated afterwards. But Gantz has come under a lot of criticism for this meeting from the opposition, right? And I'm wondering, this is coming from Netanyahu's party. Netanyahu was the guy who supported a two-state solution, was the guy who released prisoners under when John Kerry was back in office, the Secretary of State, and Barack Obama was president. He's the guy who agreed to the Trump plan, which saw a transfer 50% of the West Bank to the Palestinians, negotiated with Abu Mazen about who knows how much. I mean, like, what are they criticizing Benny Gantz for talking security?
I would argue that the characterization of the past 4 years or 5 years is not totally accurate in that, like, yes, he accepted the Trump plan, but the Trump plan would involve Israel applying sovereignty to 30% of the West Bank, to all of the places where Israelis live.
Which he also didn't do, though, right? Which he said he would do and he didn't do.
Well, he didn't do it in the end, right? Because, you know, the Americans in the end, it depends which Americans, but Trump himself and Jared Kushner sort of had misgivings about Israel wanting to do that. And they pushed forward the Abraham Accords instead, and Netanyahu accepted it. But I kind of think that Netanyahu changed. I mean, he became even more right-wing over his 12 years as prime minister, and that has a lot to do with internal pressures in Likud, I think. But also, you know, he never really supported a Palestinian state. Even he gave his Bar-Ilan speech, right? But, like, historically, he was against a Palestinian state. And I think, you know, he returned to, if not totally saying, I canceled the Bar-Ilan speech, he canceled it, like, in his actions.
Can I just tell you something that I love, though, seriously, is that, you know, you talk to Likud supporters, right, and you say what I just said, right? You know, he gave the Bar-Ilan speech, he released prisoners, he negotiated with Abu Mazen, he then accepted the Trump deal, and they'll say, no, he was fooling everyone, he was playing with them, because Bibi is such a genius that he knows how to play with everyone and maneuver in between and just fool everyone all the time. And then, and they love that, right? And there are people who are like, you know, in Hebrew, you would say, Eze gever, right? Eze totach, right? What a macho guy. And I'm like, is that good that our leader is fooling and, you know, pulling a, what's the term?
Pulling a fast one on Obama. But I would say it a different way. I mean, I wouldn't frame it the way they framed it, but I, in a way, I think that they're not wrong in the sense that, like, I think that Netanyahu gave the Bar-Ilan speech under huge pressure from Obama. And, you know, they say after he gave that Bar-Ilan speech, the conditions under which he said Israel would agree to a Palestinian state were like nearly impossible. And Biden said to Netanyahu, like, you know, you could call that whatever you want, but I don't call that a state. And it was, Biden, who's now president. And I just think if you look at Netanyahu, like, over time and over his actions, he may have said he's okay with some sort of two-state, and he may have shown up to the White House, I think it was in 2010, theoretically to open negotiations, which never actually happened. But I don't think that his actions spoke louder than his words. Now, if you're a Likudnik, you might say, is a gever, like, oh, he's amazing that he did that. And if you're not a Likudnik, you might feel otherwise.
I guess it's obvious where I stand on that.
Right. I don't think that Netanyahu is like a real supporter, that he was such a big booster of the two-state solution. He did what he had to do to like get the Americans off his back. It didn't really work, but he was that's what it seemed like to me.
I'll recognize this. To his credit, he maneuvered well throughout all of these different players and presidents and secretaries of state and be able to kind of stave off pressure when he needed to and concede a little. He was a smart player.
Right. I mean, I do think it hurts his credibility. Correct. Right? I mean, even Obama was once caught on a...
And it doesn't get him friends around the world, but he'll tell you, I don't need friends around the world. My job is to keep the state of Israel safe and secure, right? And that...
Well, he claims he has lots mission. Of friends around the world, though, if you ask him. But, but yes.
That's why all these friends around the world are embracing the Bennett-Lapid government, and no one is really missing Netanyahu at the moment. At least that's how it seems. But the Gantz and Abbas meeting on a more practical tachlis level, what came out of it? What is Israel getting, and what are the Palestinians getting?
On the practical level, the Palestinians are getting more work permits, more VIP permits for people who are members of the Palestinian Authority or who are top like business people. They can enter Israel more easily. The freeing of, I don't remember the sum, but of some sum of money of the tax and tariffs that Israel collects for them that had been frozen because of their payments to terrorists. The law in Israel states that Israel will freeze that tax money. Israel collects that tax money since the Oslo Accords, and not transfer it to the Palestinians like it's supposed to the amount that the Palestinians pay terrorists. So now I think it's like about a quarter of that amount will actually be given to the Palestinians. What Israel gets in return is sort of amorphous, I would say.
Quiet stability, security coordination.
Right. Well, because this security coordination, they didn't say they were going to stop it, at least not recently. Right. So I don't feel like we're getting that stability, hopefully, in theory. Right. We're in a mini wave of terror where there were like 8 terrorist attacks in a little over a month. And, and I think that's why Gantz felt like it was an important time to talk with Abbas, although it was in the works for a few weeks before it actually happened. So that is what Gantz wants out of its stability. But if we're looking at it in terms of what everyone got, the Palestinians got concrete things. It's not the big thing they want, which is negotiations to establish a state, but they did get concrete things, and Israel gets the amorphous promise of stability.
Yeah. Well, on today's show, like you said in the beginning, this is a Palestinian affairs show. So we have an interview and a conversation that we did with Khaled Abu Tuameh, our longtime veteran Palestinian affairs correspondent. We'll talk about why the meeting took place in Rosh Ha'ayin, what is the Gantz's home, the significance of that, more on what both sides got, how Gaza fits into this whole story, and the rockets that were then fired on Saturday mysteriously because of lightning and bad weather. Rockets went off and landed just off the coast of Yafo near Tel Aviv. And then we have an interview that I did. You had to sit that one out with Dr. Khalil Shikaki, as you mentioned, the premier Palestinian pollster. Here we go. So, Khaled, great to have you with us. Let's understand a little deeper and better, what was the purpose of this meeting that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, had with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz last week? What came out of that meeting, and why is it significant, if at all?
Well, the Palestinians say that they're hoping that such meetings would, quote, open a horizon, a political horizon with Israel, meaning we hope to launch a peace process with Israel. They're saying that this is like the first step towards reviving the peace process. But then when you look at the achievements that they scored, they are talking about mostly economic and humanitarian issues, in addition to security issues, which the Palestinians regularly don't like to talk about because of the sensitivity of the topic. But by and large, I mean, I would say that the Palestinian position right now is that, why are you criticizing us? We went to a meeting without making a single concession, and we only came back with many things. Family reunification.
But Abbas is getting criticized by the Palestinian people. There were cartoons that showed him shining or polishing Benny Gantz's shoes because the meeting was held at Benny Gantz's home in Israel. So,
and Benny Gantz, it should be said, is the defense minister, right? He's like the head of the IDF, which is
not
like,
only, you
know, right. Yeah. So he's like paying homage to
even worse,
the defense establishment.
Even worse, yeah. Benny Gantz is, quote, the war criminal.
Right.
Right. There's a case against him in the ICC. Yes. From that.
And I read also somewhere that Benny Gantz's son showed up for part of the meeting, and Benny and that son is a soldier currently in army service. So
yeah,
like,
someone in Gantz's office confirmed this to me, that the son just kind of popped his head in and said hi.
Right, which reminded me, by the way, of when Yair Netanyahu showed up when Trump and Melania were at the Balfour Prime Minister residence, and then he was taking all these photos with them as if he's in an official role. He's just, whatever, the kid. But
the criticism is not coming only from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who are criticizing him because of the meeting itself, you know. Why are you meeting with an Israeli? Why are you meeting with this war criminal, Benny Gantz? Why are you talking about security coordination? Because security coordination targets us in the West Bank and Gaza. And then there are other Palestinians, including people from his own Fatah party, who are saying this is a, quote, political and national insult, unquote, to the Palestinians. I mean, why does a president have to go to the home of a minister in Israel? This is disrespect for the Palestinian cause.
It's so interesting because I was listening to a podcast in Hebrew from Khan, from the public broadcaster. And their Palestinian affairs reporter, Gal Berger, said that said the exact opposite thing, sort of, that Gantz was showing Abbas respect by like making like a personal gesture to him.
By hosting him at his house.
Yeah.
Yeah, although the first meeting was in Ramallah and at the Mukata, right? So that was...
Well, I haven't heard that from any Palestinian, to be honest with you. Uh-huh. The only criticism I heard is, why does a president have to go to a home of a minister?
But wouldn't it be worse if he went to the Kiryat, to the defense ministry?
No, then it would have looked like an official meeting.
Then but it's not like that.
It would have looked like a working meeting or something like that, you know. But to go at night to the home of an Israeli minister, the defense minister... and not publish it, and
No photos came out of it.
Although that was the Palestinians' request, from what I understand.
I don't know, but it didn't look good.
So if I understand what you're saying, Khaled, if it was up to the Palestinians, they would have preferred for a meeting like this to take place in an official Israeli government office.
Or in Ramallah. There was less criticism of Abbas when Gantz came to Ramallah.
Right.
There's almost no criticism when the head of the Shin Bet comes to Ramallah. That's like giving them respect to the Palestinian leadership. That's like a kind of recognition. But when a president goes, you know, to the home of a minister, or when a Palestinian official has to travel to Israel, that's another issue. They see it differently.
You spoke about the economic and civilian benefits that Abbas walked away with from the Benny Gantz meeting. But Hussein Sheikh, who's the Minister for Civilian Affairs in the Palestinian Authority, said that this is actually the beginning of some sort of diplomatic process. Was that just, I don't know, wishful thinking on Hussein Sheikh's?
Well, that's what he means when he says our goal is to open a political horizon. Mm-hmm. I think that's aimed more at the Palestinian public, to show them that we are not only talking about security and civilian and economic issues. We're also talking about other issues.
Right.
Because the charge against President Abbas and Hussein Sheikh is, you know, you are functioning as if you are a branch of the defense ministry. Look, the Israelis are talking to you only about security and economic and civilian issues. What about the whole issue, the whole political issue. What about the Palestinian rights? You keep telling us, you know, you want to achieve the rights of the Palestinians, you want to restore them. What about that? And that's why, you know, we hear this talk about, we went there with the hope of resuming the diplomatic process with Israel. I think that the Palestinian leadership knows that under the current circumstances, you cannot resume the peace process with Israel. Although I do hear from a growing number of Palestinian officials in Ramallah who say, we are waiting for Yair Lapid.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
When he becomes prime minister.
Yes, when he becomes prime minister.
Because Lahav Bennett can't really do anything, right?
I mean, he only has 6 seats. So when he's not prime minister anymore, I think he's going to be very, very weak politically. And
then he won't be able to stop Yair Lapid from actually going and meeting with Mahmoud Abbas.
He could stop by bringing down the government. So it's a big,
right.
It's a big trade-off.
But Bennett, I don't see it, but I'm to the two of you, Lahav, Khaled, do you think there's any chance that Bennett would actually have a meeting with Abbas?
Bennett said in his press conference this week that he is not going to meet with Abbas.
Okay. right?
That the Palestinians pay terrorists and they pay them more if they kill more people. He doesn't see any reason to talk to Abbas in the sense of, you know, peace talks, two-state solution. He just doesn't think that those are the solutions. And so it can remain at the sort of technical economic level. That's Bennett's view of the thing.
Would Abbas want to meet with Bennett knowing that Bennett is greater Israel against a two-state solution? But let's say Bennett were to say, I'm willing to meet with him.
Well, the Abbas position, the public position is, I want to meet with an Israeli official. And he, in the past, has had no problem meeting with right-wing officials in Israel. It seems that Palestinian officials really want to meet with Ayelet Shaked. They keep raising.
Is that really true?
Yeah,
they keep raising her name.
Yeah, they keep talking about her. They believe that, you know, she can play a role in any future peace process between the Palestinians and Israel. They see her now, for example, as being the Minister of Interior. She can issue permits for Palestinians to work in Israel. She has authority over residents of East Jerusalem, and so and so. So I don't think that the Palestinian leadership has any problem meeting with right-wing people in Israel.
How do you view the... So Abbas meets with Benny Gantz. Then a couple days later, you write the story of what happens on Friday when he speaks at the Fatah founding anniversary celebration, which also marks the first terrorist attack against the state of Israel, some 57 years ago or something like that. And then he slams, and I mean, it's like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. It's like the way we used to hear of Yasser Arafat, who everyone in the West would hear in English and say, oh, the peace of the brave, right? But then he'd speak in Arabic and talk about jihad, and we're going to march and you know, commit suicide to save Jerusalem. So, like, two different Abbases here.
Yeah.
Like, well, there used to be two different
Arafats. First of all, this is Abbas in Arabic, business as usual.
Right.
Continuing with the same rhetoric, fiery rhetoric against Israel. First of all, I believe that this is directed toward the Palestinian public because he's under harsh criticism for meeting with Gantz, for collaborating with Israel, for hosting Israelis, for going to meet with Israelis, for conducting security coordination with Israel. So how do you contain or absorb that anger and frustration on the Palestinian street by lashing out against Israel? But on the other hand, and I think this is very important, many people don't notice it, that President Abbas is actually shooting himself in the foot. Because if you're accusing Israel of committing ethnic cleansing, and if you are saying that Israel is responsible for organized terrorism, and if you're saying Israel doesn't want peace, and Israel just wants to kill us, and Israel wants to Judaize Jerusalem, and Israel wants to expel us from our land, then the Palestinians say, okay, if Israel is so bad, why are you meeting with the Israelis?
Right.
So, as I said, you know, it's a vicious cycle. And in many ways...
Very optimistic, Khaled. Thank you for that.
No, but because if you don't tone down, if you don't bring down the tone...
But he's not going to bring down the tone. I mean, he's, 86 years old. He's not. He knows there's not going to be a two-state solution in his lifetime. He knows that there's not going to be with this government any big change. So he's just playing. A game.
But also, in the meantime, why radicalize your people against Israel? Why drive?
I mean, do they need him for that? Aren't they already there mostly?
They're there largely because of his incitement. I mean, don't forget the Palestinian media is largely controlled by the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
And if you watch Palestine TV these days, you will see.
Lahab's a big fan. Right.
Oh, yeah. Every night. I mean, the truth is that I look a lot, I get their emails, whatever, you know, Palestinian Media Watch. And right. They show all these crazy examples.
Yeah, but that's nothing. I mean, if you watch it, the broadcast in Arabic,
it's constant incitement indoctrination.
I mean, they're actually telling people these Jews are evil, they're bad, they don't want peace, they are legitimate targets. There's an escalating process of demonization of Jews and delegitimization of Israel. There's an attempt to depict Israel as a foreign implant.
You think it's escalating? That's yes, an interesting
yes,
point.
Yes,
in it's
recent,
getting worse.
Yes, in recent weeks, I see.
Oh, in weeks? Okay.
In recent weeks, I see it going up. Largely, I mean, some people would say that it's because of the settler violence against Palestinians. Others would say that it's because the Israeli army is shooting more Palestinians and things like that. But I do see an escalation in the rhetoric, in the anti-Israel rhetoric in the Palestinian media.
Where do the Palestinians stand right now, Khaled, in terms of relationships around the world? The Biden administration, there was a conversation I saw Mahmoud Abbas held with Vladimir Putin just a couple days ago. He's been talking about a big international summit that he'd like to put together to kind of put pressure on Israel to move things forward on the so-called peace process diplomatic track. Are they being more accepted and embraced now by the world?
Well, at least, I mean, for them, what's more important is the Biden administration, the U.S. administration. And they do see positive developments happening there because, first of all, the Biden administration is talking to them.
Right.
And they're sending all these officials to Ramallah to meet with them. And they have open channels to the Biden administration. And the rhetoric or the tone of the Biden administration is also different than the Trump administration. And for them, that's already a welcome.
Jake Sullivan met with the boss when he was here a week or two ago.
So for them, that's already a positive development on the part of the Americans. To hear the Americans say that they oppose unilateral Israeli measures such as settlement construction, that's a departure from the from the policies of the previous administration. So they are optimistic regarding the relationship with the U.S. They do feel that they are welcome back to the international community. But on the other hand, some people in the Palestinian Authority are saying that the Biden administration is not really doing enough. There's always this expectation on the part of the Palestinians from the Americans to go to Israel and knock on the table and say, Israel, do this, you must do that, this is an ultimatum, and if you don't do it, we will cut off our aid to Israel, we will punish you, Israel. And when that doesn't happen each time, the Palestinians get frustrated and angry or disappointed with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like they forget that the U.S.-Israel relationship is not only about the Palestinians. But this also reminds me of the, some news that had come out recently that after no longer being president, Trump started saying that Abbas was such a great guy, that they had such a good meeting. And we all know that after that meeting that Abbas said, may your house be destroyed and all kinds of things like that. So what do you think about this, like, sort of 180?
Well, now the Palestinians are saying, you see, we told you. And now they're actually pointing at Trump and saying, oh, he was a victim of the Jewish lobby. Uh-huh. The Jews deceived him. Now he's admitting it. And thank God he's admitting it. So that's what I'm hearing from Palestinian officials. And they're even quoting Trump on that, by the way.
What did they call David Friedman back in the day?
The
son of a dog. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. A title of honor. But how does Gaza fit into all this, Khaled? We saw on Saturday. Rockets that were fired from Gaza hit just opposite the port of the Jaffa port near Tel Aviv. The Palestinians, of course, blamed lightning and bad weather that again set off these triggers. Israel retaliated. There's been some escalation. There was a sniper that shot an Israeli Defense Ministry employee along the border, I think on Wednesday or Thursday of last week. There is this general escalation. The deterrence of Israel that Israel obtained in Gaza in the operation last May seems to be eroding. The IDF is even admitting that. How does that fit into the equation?
First of all, tensions between Gaza and the Palestinian Authority are escalating. Mm-hmm. Again, because of the ongoing crackdown by the Palestinian Authority on Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the West Bank. Secondly, these relations are very tense because Hamas is accusing the Palestinian Authority of foiling Egyptian efforts to reconstruct the Gaza Strip. They believe that Mahmoud Abbas is pressuring the Egyptians not to do it directly with Egypt, but only through the Palestinian Authority. So the split between the West Bank and Gaza is continuing, and it's not going to be solved in the near future. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, this always affects Israel. Why? Because when Hamas is angry and Hamas feels isolated and Hamas feels that they haven't really achieved anything in the post-May war, then they vent their anger and frustration towards Israel. Right. They're not going to fire rockets at Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah.
If they could, they would, though, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I hear from people in Ramallah who say, thank God Israel is sitting in the middle between the West Bank and Gaza. Otherwise, Hamas would have been firing rockets at the Muqata in Ramallah. Yeah. So in order to achieve what they want, Hamas fires at Israel with the hope that Israel would go to the Egyptians and the Egyptians would come back to Gaza and carry out the or help or facilitate the mission of reconstruction. That's how it works.
It's the language of rockets.
Yeah, and now Hamas is not going to fire rockets at Ramallah, and they're not going to fire rockets at Sinai or Cairo.
So they fire at Israel.
You fire at Israel with the hope that that would create pressure on the Egyptians and other mediators, and that they would come back and do something. But the situation in Gaza does not look good because there is growing anger and frustration. By Hamas, by Islamic Jihad, by all these groups. They feel that their isolation is growing. They feel that nothing is really moving. And they would really want to come back to center stage. They want the attention of the world to be focused on Gaza, and they feel that that's not the case right now.
So your prediction, Khaled, how does this all play out in the next few months? More just meetings?
Israel-Gaza?
Or Israel-Palestinian Authority.
Look,
Israel Gaza, there will be another operation.
Sadly,
that's the cycle we find ourselves in.
Yes. Israel Gaza, there will be another military confrontation. I don't know when. It could happen today. It could happen after 6 months.
What role is Egypt playing at this point?
You ask the Hamas people, and they say, we're disappointed with Egypt. They say it off the record because you can't come out against Egypt publicly. Mm. They're saying, we got all these promises from the Egyptians, but they haven't done really anything. They haven't reopened the Rafah border crossing. They told us that they will invest $500 million in the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip, but we haven't really seen much of it yet. They said that they will allow foreigners and other Arabs to come into Gaza and help the people in Gaza, and we don't see anything regarding that. So there is a lot of disappointment, but Hamas is very careful when it comes to Egypt. You don't denounce Egypt in public. You don't say bad things about Egypt because the backlash will be very severe. Egypt will punish you. Until today, Ismail Haniyeh is not allowed to come back to Gaza because the Egyptians never forgave him for leaving Gaza and going to Iran to the funeral of Qasem Soleimani. Since then, he hasn't been back to Gaza. He had to go and live in Qatar. So with Gaza, I'm less optimistic. Now, with the Palestinian Authority, I believe that things are moving in the right direction. I mean, we're not going to achieve peace and harmony and love between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, but at least the stability is good. The situation in the West Bank could have been much worse were it not for the security coordination between Israel and the West Bank or the Palestinian Authority, and were it not for these Israeli gestures. Ironically, most of the Palestinian public hates Israel. They're against the meetings with Israelis. They're against normalization with Israel. But when Israel makes some kind of gestures, they welcome them and they accept them. And that has some kind of a short-term moderating effect on the Palestinian public.
Okay. Well, Khaled Abu Tuameh, the Jerusalem Post Palestinian Affairs Correspondent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So it's great to have with us Dr. Khalil Shikaki, who is a professor of political science and the director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research based in Ramallah. But he's also, since 2005, been a senior fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. So, Dr. Shikaki, thanks you so much for joining the Jerusalem Post podcast. And I wanted to talk to you about the basically following the meeting that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz just a few days ago, what's the feeling on the Palestinian street right now? You know, with this current government in Jerusalem, the government led by Bennett and Lapid, is there a sense that something can actually happen? Have people given up hope on some sort of diplomatic process? Where do you see things?
Well, the overall picture is one of pessimism. It is not positive. Attitudes are basically that nothing is going to come out in terms of ending occupation from any context between the Palestinian and the Israeli side, that Israel has no intention of ending its occupation anytime soon, and that the chances for reaching any agreement on a two-state solution is simply not there. A very small minority, a quarter, and if we're lucky, perhaps a third, might have different views, but two-thirds to three-quarters are indeed highly pessimistic about anything Israeli-Palestinian. Mm-hmm. However, given this overall picture, it seems that there is a desire among the Palestinian public to see some kind of progress, some resolution to issues that are impeding their daily living conditions in a manner that would make it easier for Palestinians to pursue their socioeconomic life. The expectation is this might be doable with this defense minister and with this government, unlike the previous government, where Netanyahu was not seen as being willing to move in any positive direction with the Palestinians. There is a perception that the current Israeli government, because of the makeup of the government, is more willing to consider some confidence-building measures that could go some way in addressing some of the basic needs, family unification issues, basically issuing IDs to people who for various technical reasons were denied such IDs, allowing a greater number of Palestinian laborers to work in Israel, some additional matters related to transfer of funds to the PA, perhaps some better environment for export, and so on, are things that are seen doable with this Israeli government. But, as I said, given the overall level of pessimism, the expectation is that this Israeli government is no different than the previous Israeli government.
But I'm curious, Dr. Shikaki, you did a study back in September, I think it was, that showed that almost 80% of Palestinians would like to see Mahmoud Abbas step down. And you also had another study which showed that there was a dramatic surge in Palestinian support for Hamas following the war in Gaza last May. So what do these findings tell us about the future Palestinian leadership? Like, I understand that it's easy, it's natural to blame the Israeli side, but what about the Palestinian side? It doesn't seem like Palestinians are happy with their own leaders.
No, Palestinians do not just blame the Israeli side. Far from it. And you are absolutely right. 80% of September said and this was also confirmed earlier in June, somewhere between 75% to 80% in the last 6 months or so have demanded the resignation of President Abbas. There is a very strong belief among the Palestinians that one reason why things are not moving with the Israeli side isn't just Netanyahu and the makeup of the Israeli government, but also that the Palestinian leadership is too weak in confronting Israel, that the Palestinian leadership continues to deal with Israel and the Israeli government with continued coordination, both in civil and security matters, as if there is a peace process, as if the Palestinian Authority will one day indeed become a state, when in fact, it realizes this is not going to happen and that this Palestinian elite that continues to deal with Israel as if this is business as usual is doing so in order to stay in power, not to serve the Palestinian cause. There are, of course, a lot of other reasons why the Palestinians are unhappy with Abbas, the failure to reconcile Fatah and Hamas and reunify the West Bank and Gaza is being put mostly on Abbas these days, that he, not Hamas, is the one that is make, or more than Hamas, is the one who is making it more difficult to reunify. There is tremendous anger and frustration with governance, the belief that the Palestinian Authority is a corrupt institution, that there are no liberties or freedoms, and that the killing, for example, of Nizar Banat some 5-6 months ago by the security services on the Palestinian side have also made people come to the conclusion that right. this Palestinian Authority is becoming more and more authoritarian, serving only the ruling elite, does not care about the people, is not willing or perhaps even able to combat corruption. So in this environment, what you said about Hamas comes in, but on top of everything that I've just said, when we were in September, and again before that, in even in larger percentages, in June, the popularity of Hamas shot up. There was a big spike in its popularity that came as a result of the May war, the perception. Every time there is a war between Israel and Hamas, we see a significant spike in support for Hamas. This seems to be a natural reaction. People immediately shift from opposing to supporting Hamas during times in which there is bloodshed. But it is not just an emotional reaction to bloodshed in Gaza. It is more about the perception that while Hamas is definitely not better and perhaps even much worse than Fatah and Abbas in terms of governance, in terms of liberties and freedoms and so on, Hamas is better than Abbas in terms of confronting Israel. So if the context is one of war, then there is a perception that dominates the thing.
Then Hamas comes out on top, right?
That Hamas can deliver. But right. if what you take, for example, the survey we did 3 months before the one we did in June, when there was a decline in support for Hamas and a significant rise in support for Fatah. Not Abbas, by the way, but just Fatah. Why was that happening? It was happening because in March, unlike in June, people expected elections to take place in May. And as their thinking shifted, the context, in other words, shifted from issues dealing with confrontations with Israel to how to manage our domestic environment, how to return back to a democracy and so on, Hamas was not the answer. And so people started to abandon Hamas and to support Fatah.
But we do know is that those elections were ultimately canceled, right? The parliamentary elections as well as the presidential elections. And part of the reason, at least, that was reported in the press and, you know, us at the Jerusalem Post reported, like other places, that this was because of a feeling by President Abbas and the Fatah party that they were going to lose. They were going to lose to Hamas in the parliament. And there was a chance that Ismail Haniyeh, if the leader of Hamas, who's now living in Qatar, but if he were to run against Mahmoud Abbas, he would actually win. And therefore, Abbas decided to cancel those elections. And I'm curious, based on your polling, is there someone who you can put your finger on, Dr. Shikaki, and say this is would be the future leader? Because we know that Mahmoud Abbas is not a young man anymore. He's 86, I think it is. Who would lead the Palestinian Authority the day after? Is there the data show anything?
You're right. The prevailing perception among Palestinians, and this is also my own personal view, is that Abbas canceled the elections that were scheduled for May because he knew he was going to lose it, but also because he thought that Fatah, the official Fatah list that he was putting forward, was not going to win a majority, and he didn't want to form a coalition with other like-minded right. parties or powers. The truth is, there was no evidence at all that Hamas would win. To the contrary, it was very clear that the trend was shifting and that Fatah renegades, those factions who did not want to be part of Abbas Fatah, were competing against him. Like Marwan Barghouti's list, Our surveys in Marsh and our surveys in the last 15 years, in fact, show that Marwan Barghouti is today spending life sentences in an Israeli jail. Barghouti is perceived today by the Palestinians as the leader of the future. He has been able to win in every single survey we've conducted, and we've conducted dozens and dozens of surveys during this period. He wins against Ismail Haniyeh. When Haniyeh wins decisively against Abbas, and he wins by anywhere between 60 to 65% of the vote almost every time. Clearly, this is the person who should have been the candidate of Fatah in the elections that were scheduled for May for the parliament and 3 months later for the presidency. Had Abbas made up his mind that he wasn't going to run for the presidency and that he would pick the person who was most popular to lead Fatah, then he would probably have gone ahead with the elections in May for the parliament and later for the presidency. And by now we would have had a return to democracy with the parliament and with Barghouti elected as the president.
Yeah, although you know, like I do, Dr. Shkaki, that electing Barghouti is going to be problematic. I was a reporter back in 2004. I was in the Tel Aviv district courtroom when he was sentenced and sent to jail for five life sentences. And excuse me, even if he was elected, I mean, it would be complicated for Israel what it would do. I don't know what any government, but especially this government led by a right-wing politician like Naftali Bennett, if he would be willing to release someone like that from prison. But that's a whole other question that I don't know if there's a good answer to.
The truth is the president of the Palestinian Authority, according to the Palestinian Basic Law, does very little in managing the Palestinian Authority. He is mostly opposition as head of the PLO. That is the counterpart for Israel in negotiating a permanent agreement to end the Israeli occupation. The prime minister is responsible for managing the daily affairs. So Barghouti being elected as president, in my view, isn't really going to change things much. The current prime minister would probably continue to be the same person doing the same thing. Barghouti would be the person that Israel, if and when Israel decides it wants to sit down and negotiate a permanent agreement with the Palestinians, Barghouti would be the address. He is in an Israeli jail, as you and I have said, and if Israel wants to meet with him and negotiate, this would be one option they have. In the same way as things happened in South Africa.
Although, you know, joking, and I don't know if this is the right thing, but people were making jokes with Netanyahu's trial that if Netanyahu ends up being sent to jail, we re-elect him prime minister, put him next to Barghouti, and then they can negotiate together. They won't have a choice but to sit down and talk. Dr. Shkaki, I just want to ask you just really quickly. I saw another study that you did together with the organization B'Tselem, the human rights left-wing organization here in Israel, that spoke about how the Palestinians believe that a majority of Israelis are actually opposed to a two-state solution and want apartheid. They believe it's continued apartheid, but they want a continued control of the West Bank and Judea and Samaria. That's quite depressing, because I think that most Israelis, if you actually come to them and say, listen, there's a peaceful way to disengage and to separate from the Palestinians, I would think that most Israelis would want that. No?
Most Israelis do not support a two-state solution. And most Israeli Jews, let me correct that. And most Palestinians also today do not support a two-state solution. The question was about the perception of the other. If we ask the Palestinians today, do Israelis support, or Israeli Jews support a two-state solution? The answer is no. Most Palestinians do not believe that Israel is willing to pay the price for ending occupation, building a long-term peace or permanent peace based on a two-state solution. This is the prevailing perception today. It is not something that has always been there. There were times, in fact, even when Sharon was the prime minister, when we asked the public about not just the public, but also about Sharon himself, we did find a lot more optimism at that time about the willingness of Israeli Jews and the Israeli prime minister to make peace and end the Israeli occupation. This is not the case anymore. The years under Netanyahu, I believe, have done significant psychological damage in terms of the willingness of the Palestinians to trust Israelis. The prevailing perception today is Israelis do not want peace.
Well, Dr. Shikaki, while I appreciate the assessment, it is a bit pessimistic. We have to hope that maybe, as you said in the beginning, that maybe this government, this new government in Israel, together maybe with the Palestinian Authority, can do something to change those sentiments. And I think we all have to hope, you in Ramallah, myself in Jerusalem, that this will be possible. But right now, the data as you presented doesn't show that favorably. But thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Good talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Please join us next week. We'll be back here and in all of the different platforms where you can find your podcasts.